How many urinary tract infections are due to meat?
Does reducing air pollution impact everybody the same?
How does a common bacterial infection and genetics interact in gastric cancers?
And what do we know about pediatric mental health hospitalizations over the last decade?
That's what we're talking about this week on Double T Health Watch, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a Baltimore-based medical journalist.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
And Dean, I'm going to leave it up to you. How would you like to start this week?
Let's start with the thing I led off with, air pollution. Does reducing it affect everybody the same? It's pretty clear that we're doing our best to decrease air pollution and especially exposure to what's called fine particulate matter, particles that have a diameter of less than 2.5 micrometers. So we call it PM 2.5. And the EPA has recognized that air pollution levels are related to mortality really across the country. There's a current effort to get the PM 2.5 level down to 12 micrograms per cubic meter. It's now about 20. So let's say you do that. Who benefits and do some people benefit more than others? What the authors did was they looked at 623 million person years of Medicare data from 73 million people over the age of 65 from 2000 to 2016. And they estimated two things. One is the annual PM 2.5 exposure and the mortality. But they looked at particular subpopulations. They looked at Black versus white. They also looked at income, really low income, people that were on Medicaid. So these are people that are about 200% of the poverty level. And then everybody above that. And what they discovered is, okay, well, you can get it down to 12. That's beneficial. But if you can go from 12 to 8, you still get an incremental benefit. Overall, it reduces the mortality by about 4 or 5%. It impacts African-Americans more than whites and higher income African-Americans more than lower income African-American and even lower income whites. That implies that, first of all, there's an income disparity. More importantly, the racial difference doesn't have anything to do with the race. It has to do more with where they live. African-Americans are more likely to be exposed to higher particulate matter and live in areas, for example, where there are freeways and there's more exposure to it. There's a 45% better mortality reduction among African-Americans than there is against whites.
We certainly have circled around this particular observation many times when we've taken a look at proximity to highways and the degree of particulate matter, and specifically in different countries around the world where there is a higher density of a population immediately adjacent to these kinds of structures. It's unclear to me, though, exactly what we do about this outside of let's move them out of there.
This is one way to decrease health disparities. So I think that's very helpful. Besides moving, and that's going to be very difficult, it's just to reduce particulate matter across the board. The change in the fuel we use, it's a change in our driving habits. And in fact, when you look at the particulate matter density just across the United States, it's clearly been decreasing. But what the study shows is you can still get incremental benefit going even lower to help decrease some of the health disparities between whites and African Americans.
That's in the New England Journal of Medicine. So let's stay there and let's turn to this relationship between the common bacterium Helicobacter pylori and recombination genes that people may have and their susceptibility to developing gastric cancer. This is a study that includes a couple different databases from Japan. One of them is the Biobank Japan. What they did was look at germline pathogenic variants in 27 cancer predisposing genes and the risk of gastric cancer in a sample of 10,000 plus patients who already had gastric cancer and 38,000 plus controls who did not from this Biobank Japan. They also took a look at the combined effect of the pathogenic variants and Helicobacter pylori or H. pylori infection status on risk of gastric cancer. This was in 1,400 plus patients with gastric cancer, just shy of 6,000 controls from the hospital-based epidemiologic research program at Achai Cancer Center. What they found was that sure enough, if you had one of these pathogenic variants and you had Helicobacter pylori infection, you were more likely to develop gastric cancer.
I found this one really interesting. The first thing they did was they identified 9 different genes, genetic abnormalities people were born with, that increased the risk of gastric cancer. 8 of these hadn't really been previously described. Then they said, okay, what if you have that and an H. pylori infection. And by the way, half of the world is infected with H. pylori. Is it increased the risk of cancer about 16-fold? We do know, for example, that H. pylori helps to cause gene abnormalities in the stomach. And these genetic variants that people have, it predisposes them to not be able to fix those genetic variants. And it predisposes to cancer. So for example, at 85 years of age, if a person has an H. pylori infection and one of these variants, the cumulative risk of gastric cancer was 45%. For those that were non-carriers affected with H. pylori, it's only about 14%.
What it does for me is it nails down some of the hypotheses that have been circulating for quite a long time about the confluence of factors that ultimately end up giving rise to cancer. One of the questions I have is it possible that these pathogenic variants in the genes actually predispose to persistent H. pylori infection?
Well, that's an interesting question. This particular study doesn't answer it. It does say that one of the ways we can reduce the risk of gastric cancer then is to eradicate H. pylori infection, especially with those that have one of these genetic variants.
At 85 years of age, this higher cumulative risk, it's kind of like, wow, you're 85 and you develop this. That's not that I'm not sympathetic, but we do develop things the older we get.
We do. But if you knew that giving someone an antibiotic could reduce your risk by 67%, that's a pretty effective cancer prevention method.
Yep, I agree with that.
Elizabeth, let's move from the older population to the pediatric population. This is in JAMA, and it's a look at pediatric mental health hospitalizations from 2009 to 2019. And why this is relevant is if you just go back about 4 or 5 years, it was shown that approximately 1 in 6 youths in the U.S. have a mental health condition. And unfortunately, less than half received any mental health services. When you take a look just around the country, if you look at rural counties, more than half of them don't have any outpatient mental health facility that provides treatment for children. And even in the urban set, more than a third don't have it. Over the last several decades, we've decreased the capacity to treat kids as an outpatient. Ask yourself, what's that done to inpatients? They looked at that database and they looked at over 4.7 million pediatric hospitalizations. What happened is if you looked at those that were just due to mental health, during that period, they increased from about 160,000 to almost 202,000. And unfortunately, when you look at the major causes for that, about 2/3 to 3/4 of it is due to depression. And about 2/3 of those, there's actually a suicidal attempt or self-injury. That's increased 160% over that decade, and it's primarily affecting kids in the adolescent range, 10 to 14 or 11 to 14. This is an epidemic of huge proportion, and it affects a most vulnerable population.
I think this is just such an incredibly difficult problem. I'm glad that this study is pointing to it and providing us with some data. We've talked a lot about the incidence of mental health issues during the pandemic. On the converse, I've also been hearing a lot of discussion about why are we telling adolescents that they're abnormal? This is normal for them to experience some mood swings and all kinds of things. And what's the role of social media in this? That's why I say, gosh, it's just really a thorny problem.
It is, Elizabeth. Because this particular study covers the period from 2009 to 2019, it predates COVID. So these were the mental health issues before COVID. And you and I have talked before, based upon data, of how it's exacerbated it even more. It clearly needs to be addressed.
How would you approach it?
As you mentioned, some of this is what I don't want to call normal behavior, but normal part of the life cycle. And it's even worse when there's social instability or there's peer or family conflict, as you mentioned, social media as well. But what's made things even worse is the fact there's been a decrease in outpatient facilities where you'd like to treat the kids, and also a decrease in inpatient facilities. So increasing access to outpatient care is going to be imperative.
Finally, let's turn to the journal One Health. Mobile genetic elements to identify E. coli infections in people that are not in the intestine. They basically did a comparative genomic analysis of a large collection of contemporaneous, geographically matched clinical and meat source E. coli isolates. Then they identified among that population 17 source-associated mobile genetic elements, and those are plasmids and bacteriophages. And what we know about those are like the jumping genes. They help E. coli acquire different characteristics during its lifespan, if you will. And they ultimately ended up, by the incorporation of their model and the study of both transposons and plasmids, that 8% of human, mostly urinary tract infections in their study population were caused by these things that ultimately arose from zoonoses, and they say from meat. That's a large number of UTIs that we can finger and say this came from a meat source, a dietary meat source.
So there's a huge emphasis on what's called One Health now, not just to focus on human health, but it's how health across all the animal spectrum affects human health. And we know, by the way, that most E. coli infections that are transmitted from animals or meat to humans are actually GI infections. People close down meatpacking plants and they take meat off the shelves. But this thought that meat can actually cause urinary tract infections, that's kind of novel. The fact that it's an animal to human transmission is pretty remarkable. Now you say 8% is not very high. But you have to remember that E. coli causes approximately 6 to 8 million urinary tract infections each year in the U.S. And that means about 8%. That means somewhere between 500,000 and 250,000 arise from the meat that we eat. The main value of this study, though, is it uses certain techniques and genetic analysis to identify the source of these infections. And these are genetic analysis modeling that hasn't been done before. So this can transmit to other zoonotic infections.
And I think we're going to see, if I were a betting gal, a whole lot more of this kind of analysis coming down the pike.
It is. And one of the things that our listeners need to be aware of is the fact that many of these animals are fed antibiotics to help them to grow and to be healthy before they're sent to the packing plant. And so these particular infections were resistant to some of the usual antibiotics we typically use. So this issue of transmission from animals to humans and back and forth really is clinically relevant.
On that note then, that's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up, make healthy choices.